Hey, it is my great privilege tonight to introduce a very good friend of mine. Don Chaffer is going to speak to us tonight. And a lot of you guys know Don. Don is the founder with his wife of a band called Waterdeep, and they are amazing musicians. And part of the reason, I mean, I don't invite Don up here to preach to us tonight because of his music, although I think his music is amazing. One of the reasons I asked Don to come up here, it was just because he very simply wrestles hard with God. And maybe part of the reason I like his music is it's reflected so much the reality of that. And so I'm going to invite Don to come up here and talk to us about his life in God and kind of whatever he wants to share about tonight. So, all right, my friend.
Hi. I'm going to anchor myself to this because I don't have a microphone stand or a guitar. I thought briefly about wearing a harmonica rack, but I decided that would be a little distracting and might look like I had an orthodontic problem. So it's really hot, and it's sort of fun to watch this almost screensaver-like thing of these fans appearing and disappearing. You don't get to see it so much from, you know, where you are, unless maybe a few in the front row turn around and face that way for the rest of the service, which would be just fine for me. No, my wife and I were married actually in June over at the Church House of Westport with no air conditioning, and I was in a tuxedo and she was in a dress, and most of the people were dressed up, and it was hot. Very hot, and most people remember that, and the fact that it was long and hot, which made it hotter. My first note is self-introduction, and it says self-description if necessary, and I'm going to bypass that, because if I were to start saying that I'm in a band called Waterdeep with my wife, it would be superfluous. But my wife and I have been here for over a year and a half, and we really love it. It feels to me like the Jacob's Well spiritual atmosphere is very sincere and relaxed, and being somewhat of a, as Tim honorably referred to it as wrestling, I would call it obsessive compulsive, spiritually speaking. It's nice to be here and feel like I can kind of take a deep breath and, you know, do that. So the theme tonight that I want to talk about is the rediscovery of our lost childlikeness. I want to start with a scripture from Matthew chapter 18, verses 2 to 4. You can get it out if you want to, but I'll be done by the time you find it. Jesus called a small child over to him and put the child among them. And then he said, "I assure you, unless you turn from your sins and become as little children, you will never get into the kingdom of heaven. Therefore, anyone who becomes as humble as this little child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven." I'm a big fan of music. I have a whole lot of CDs. I was relieved when a friend of mine... Oh, that's too long a story. I got to avoid tangents. It's too hot. So this one band that I like is called Little Feet, and they were in 1978 or so. The lead singer, Lowell George, and don't believe the hype, nothing after Lowell George died is any good. He died in 1978, and they released an album called Hoy Hoy in 1981. In the liner notes, Bonnie Raitt says this thing. She says, "I miss Little Feet as much as I miss being 8 years old." And I remember reading that and just thinking about it for a long time, about the idea of missing being 8 years old. And if you could permit me just to establish a mood here, there's no real point to most of these little vignettes I'm going to give, but maybe they'll get you in the mindset of being a kid, or at least being me as a kid. And it's kind of like, I decided this is the Chris Farley show moment, you know, where he goes, "You remember when..." That was cool. So that's the goal here. I was asking Tim if it was Mattel, and I believe it was, that made the three-button football game where you had the brightest LED, your defenders had slightly dimmer ones, and the opponents had dimmer still ones, and so you navigated your relatively bright LED across the screen, and feeling, though, like you were Gale Sayers or somebody. How was that for an obscure football reference? Tearing down the field. I remember locking myself in the closet in the summer playing this game just so I could see the LEDs more brightly. Two, I remember reading a science book and then going out into the side yard and laying on the ground watching ants and thinking about grass and how big they must be, how blades of grass must be really big to ants, and the fact that this is the same side yard that we play football on, and isn't that amazing, and isn't it cool that I'm thinking about it. Three, I remember riding my bike with my two best friends, and when we got old enough that we could actually ride our bikes some distance to Burger King, And we had a camera, too. My mom had given me her Yashica 35mm camera, and I still have photographs of this particular outing. And the funniest one of them is one of my friends holding the, like, really thin aluminum ashtray under my other friend's mouth, and he's going like that, you know? And then the irony of it was that about 5 minutes later, that friend actually threw up at Burger King. Four, I had a treehouse with a bicycle wheel attached, like a without the tire on it, just the rim, attached by two boards onto a like a basketball backboard, you know, made out of particle board, which, for those of you thinking about the experiment, does get soggy in the rain, which I didn't understand why they made basketball backboards out of those in the first place. But so I had this treehouse that was basically, you know, the size of a basketball backboard, and it had a pulley. The wheel was the pulley so that I could have a bucket attached to the other end and pull things up there. And I never could figure out what I should pull up there because my Star Wars figures fit in my pockets, and that seemed to be all the more exciting thing I could think to drag up there, but I had it nonetheless. And E, speaking of useless activities as a child, I remember that one of my best friends, we decided we were going to learn how to do encryption or codes, and we would communicate important messages to one another this way. And we not only created the codes, but also the very lengthy way in which we would communicate them to one another. And so he, this one particular, you know, code delivery system was that he would ride his bike down my side, by my side yard, and I would be in the window watching. And he would pretend that he wrecked into the grass and then surreptitiously drop a code on the ground. And then he'd go, oh gosh, you know. And then get up and ride away. And then I would go out as if I were weeding the side yard, which of course I did regularly. And about 45 seconds after I picked up the code during the weeding process, and I gave myself a good 30 to 45 second pad so that nobody would notice, you know, that I did that right as I picked up the paper. And then I'd go in and read it, and it would say, Star Wars figures rock, or something like that. So that's childhood, as the way I remember it. And then things got really poopy in my family for a while. My dad disappeared for a year, and it was tough. And then I went through puberty, which was difficult, also poopy. And then I hit college. I was out from under my parents, and somehow that was like this revisited childhood, you know? And that was when we crafted these sugar runs at midnight, where we'd go to Dillon's and buy a pint each of Ben and Jerry's, and then swing by Dunkin' Donuts, which I guess was open that late, or else I've got my story wrong. And we'd buy those powdered sugar covered with not the cream, but just the pure sugar stuff. Do you know what I'm talking about? And a cup of hot chocolate. And we'd dip the donuts in hot chocolate while eating ice cream, and we were just freaked out, you know. And that would enable us then to, you know, go play frisbee at night or something and hit each other in the face with something we couldn't see or whatever it was. And I remember staying up till 3 or 4 in the morning because of a good conversation, and I remember skipping class just to do something fun, and I remember being sure that we were all going to change the world, you know, as soon as we graduated. Now, undeniably, at some point, pragmatism enters the picture, right? But the main goal here is not to talk about the value of pragmatism, because I think that there's something about being pragmatic or realistic or practical or whatever that it misses the point of childhood to some degree. And I think if we want to understand what it is that Christ is trying to communicate here when he talks about the humility of a child and having to be like a child to enter the kingdom of heaven, that we have to dismiss that just for a moment. So just suspend that in your minds. I also suspect that for some of us, as I mentioned, my poopy period, which is a sort of an amusing, to me, amusing way of referring to a bad time in your family, that all of us also have some, or most of us have some part of our childhood that was difficult. And I think that it's easy to dismiss sort of childlikeness from that perspective to feel like it's ill-equipped to deal with suffering. But I think we'd miss part of what Jesus wants to say there as well, and that, you know, children don't easily anesthetize themselves to things. They can cry when they're sad. They can receive comfort a lot of times easily. They can cling to the idea that the world or life is still good, even if they're encountering difficult things. They're quick to forgive a lot of times, resilient, and they share their feelings, which are all sort of things that you forsake as you encounter more and more suffering. And I think somewhere along the way, we lose our way, and we lose that aspect of ourself which is childlike. And that's the thing that I want to talk to you about tonight is how is it that we lose ourselves and how is it that we can regain ourselves. And I'm just going to give you three little examples and then one sort of way back for each one. And let me just read you one more scripture here from Matthew 19, verses 13 to 14. Some children were brought to Jesus so he could lay his hands on them and pray for them. The disciples told them not to bother him, but Jesus said, "Let the children come to me, don't stop them, for the kingdom of heaven belongs to such as these." And he put his hands on their heads and he blessed them before he left. If you've been alive for very long, you've at some point probably been able to relate to the disciples in the kind of sending away of a child or of childlikeness and feeling for one reason or another that that was the appropriate thing to do. And so without further ado, let's dig into what some of those things are. The first thing that I wanted to talk about, and each of these we're going to ask two questions: how did we lose ourselves and how do we find ourselves again? The first one is busyness. It's easy to get really busy. That's maybe the most obvious interpretation of what the disciples do there. They're getting all down and with the ministry thing, and they're like, you know, shoo, little kid. I don't want to dwell on this one too long because I really believe that being a part of the Jacob's Well community, you're going to hear this a lot because I think it's something, especially being an urban church, that's pretty crucial to our spiritual lives. And in fact, it's the thing that I mentioned earlier about the relaxed sense of spirituality here that I think is so, hey, it's water, I'll take some. That's so life-giving for me is not to be as obsessed, but have this sort of still receiving approach to God. And so I think within the community, you know, Tim's sermons touch on this subject. Troy Redstone did the monastic Lenten journey and is doing a thing on Tuesday nights that covers ancient spiritual disciplines. And then even the Tuesday night thing in general, the fact that we've got stuff like poetry and art and yoga, all these things sort of focus on being able to clear our minds of the cares of life and just get sort of still in some way or another. So we lose ourselves through busyness, and we can find ourselves again through stillness or contemplation. Another way that I think we lose ourselves is embarrassment. There's a lot of things that kids do that we don't do anymore because they're embarrassing, like running, yelling, playing, expressing affection, singing, believing in things without irony, confessing our fears, crying, or admitting weakness. I think kids are unnerving in that regard, or at least the idea of living like a kid in those regards is unnerving because it's it'd be a little shocking to be that way. I mean, especially, you know, like that, you know. I've often thought about that in terms of rock and roll concerts too, which I do. You know, people go, you know, rock, like that kind of a, like when we're done playing or something, and I think that'd be interesting in the office if you yelled at people at the top of your lungs and, you know, like that. Which I guess is a lot of what high school's about to some degree, so. Embarrassment is a lot of times it's a byproduct of shame. We're ashamed of something or other, and a lot of times shame is a byproduct of fear, and a lot of times fear, I think, is a byproduct of suffering. And so without getting really deep and heavy on this particular issue, because I'm going to save that for the third thing, suffice it to say that on just a surface level embarrassment, I think there's actually a surface sort of solution for it, and that is that we can find ourselves again by having a sense of humor. It's real possible to be a Christian and not have a sense of humor. And it's a great tragedy because I like to think of it in terms of a sense of humor is not necessarily something that will fuel life. It's not gasoline, but it's kind of like oil. If you don't have it, you're eventually going to ruin your engine. And there's a movie called Max that I just saw recently about this fictional character named Max Rothman, who's an art dealer in Germany in about 1918, and one of his young artists is named Adolf Hitler. And that much is true, that Hitler was an artist before he took an interest in politics, unfortunately. And one of the conspicuous features about the way that this Noah Taylor, I think is his name, plays Hitler is he has absolutely no sense of humor. He takes himself deadly seriously, and he just can't possibly catch it. And this Max Rothman character, who's played by John Cusack, has a real sort of lightness about him, even though he lost his arm in the First World War. He has this sort of desire to experience life, to the full, and he's constantly trying, and he mentions this even in the movie, that trying to get Hitler to lighten up, and he can't succeed. And so the moral of the story is, get a sense of humor or be Hitler. No, I do think we shouldn't underestimate the power of a sense of humor, because it really can be the kind of thing, especially towards yourself and your own struggles and your own weaknesses. Being able to laugh at yourself can do you a world of good, you know? My wife and I occasionally, I remember in specific that we get in a lot of fights, but just because we're both sort of fighting kind of people. And we have this one particular fight, and it had been a while, and we both called each other jerks or something like that. And I was walking up to the kitchen, and I just started laughing. She goes, "What?" I said, "This is a really good one, isn't it?" And then she started laughing, and everything was fine. So the third way that I wanted to cover that we can lose ourselves is in tragedy. I think there are a million tragedies that human beings encounter. And this is something that's going to be pretty close to me, because I, in the last 2 years, have lost both my parents, my mother to leukemia and my father to alcohol poisoning. And it's been a really difficult time, which I suppose goes without saying. But it's been such a difficult time that it's caused me, on an intuitive level, not so much a rational level, you know, more heart than mind, to question everything and to try to re-understand my life in some meaningful way in light of the late breaking news that my life is a mess. And I think that that response of trying to say, okay, now what, in the face of tragedy, is exactly how the children get sent away, so to speak. And that's how we lose track of all these sort of lighter things that happen, that lighter aspects of ourselves, you know, and the parts of us which are more trusting and more vulnerable and that kind of thing. And again, in order to sort of hopefully establish a mood, I just wanted to list some random tragedies that people experience, which sounds funny but isn't. And it actually, there are 26 of them, because that's when the outliner thing got to Z and I didn't want to go to AA. So if your tragedy's not in here, it's just because I only could list 26. Which is funny, but this is not going to be funny here pretty quick. Going through a divorce, the death of a loved one, being sick, enduring a fire, being rejected from a social circle, losing a job, having a miscarriage, becoming addicted to drugs or alcohol, being mocked, losing a large amount of money, enduring a tornado, making a professional mistake that causes other people to suffer, losing someone addicted to drugs or alcohol, breaking up with a boyfriend or a girlfriend, suffering sexual abuse, losing function of some part of the body through injury, losing one's popularity for one reason or another, thinking that one had done well at something and finding that others felt the opposite way, becoming the child of a divorce, being greatly misunderstood, having communication with a loved one cut off against your will, the death of a pet, seeing the destruction of some place dear to you, going to war, moving away from family or close friends, and having a car accident. Part of the reason that I wanted to list all this is because I think it's real easy for us not to remember what's happened. It's easy to lose touch with the fact that we all suffer. Philo of Alexandria said, "Be kind, for everyone you meet is fighting a great battle." But it's as if we're acting like we're not in a great battle and that everything's just fine. I've heard more than one person in my life make light of losing someone to death or losing or having, not make light of, but minimize the pain of living through a divorce or going through the death of a loved one or something. And I just think it really doesn't work. That stuff is so powerful and so overwhelming that it will manifest itself in your life in one way or another, and usually by ejecting the childlike attributes of your life from you. And you begin to lose the enjoyment of certain foods, and you stop laughing as much, and those kinds of things. And, of course, these tragedies that I listed are varying in intensity, but, like I said, they always shape our lives. I'm not going to explain a great deal more about how we're affected by it, but my main point here is the idea that it does affect us, and that it's wise if we acknowledge that and interact with it. I think especially the idea of allowing ourselves to grieve. America is a funny country in that regard, that, you know, I think I don't know what bereavement policies are at companies, but I wouldn't be surprised if they're too short. You compare it to the American experience of grief at losing someone to death, compared to, like, say, the Hebrew experience that you encounter in the Bible with the mourners, and, you know, it's just there's so much more time that's taken to mark that passing and to let your heart breathe and to let your heart suffocate if that's where it's at, you know. And I think giving ourselves more room to do that, I think, is one of the keys. But as far as how we find ourselves again, the main thing that I want to focus on is finding the right symbols or plot line to our life. And on the symbolism, they're both basically the two ways of saying the same thing. But there's this guy, author and professor named Clyde Kilby, who used to say, symbols bind up reality for us. If I have a car accident, it's a car accident. It doesn't mean anything, right? But what inevitably happens to all human beings is, upon the car accident happening, there's a sort of reappraisal of life, because you ask yourself, essentially, what does this mean? Why did I have this car accident? If then I have another car accident 2 weeks later and something worse happens to me, or if somebody else has a car accident, or, you know, if these tragedies begin to get strung together, it's unavoidable that you will begin to ask what it means. Because you might convince yourself that it doesn't mean anything at first, although that's a symbol in itself. So the way we symbolize these things, what we make of them, how we interpret them, I think is pretty crucial to how we experience reality. The plot line thing comes from a little bit from Frederick Buechner, Buechner, if you're German, but I've heard Buechner and we're in America. So he's a novelist, and then also has written several nonfiction works, four or five of them now, which are sort of memoirs. And his father committed suicide when he was at the age of 10, and his mother immediately moved him and his two brothers to Bermuda and asked them never to speak about their father again. So he has a lot of stuff that he works through in these. And he says this about writing a book about his life. He says, "When it comes to putting my own life into words, however, the doubts persist. Are the events I described anything like the way they really happened? As I look back over them, I think I see patterns, casual relationships, suggestions of meaning that I was mostly unaware of at the time. Have I gotten them anything like right? E.M. Forrester, the novelist, says that story is a narrative of events arranged chronologically, as in the king died and then the queen died, whereas a plot, although also a narrative of events, concentrates more on the because of things, as in the king died and then the queen died of grief. This account, the one you have in your hands, is full of becauses. The question is, have I actually discovered them, or after long practice as a novelist, have I simply made them up? Have I concocted a plot out of what is only a story? Who knows? I can only say that to me, life in general, including my life in particular, feels like a plot. And I find that a source both of strength and of fascination." So let's assume that life is a plot, that things do mean something, and that we all symbolize them whether we like it or not. The question then becomes, how do you symbolize them? What's the plot line that you set your life against? What are the symbols? What's the arrangement of symbols that you use to signify, especially tragedies and losses in your life? And I would say that the big problem we as human beings run into is essentially applying bad stories to our lives. And I'm only going to touch on two, and even do that sort of briefly, and then I'm going to move on to what I believe is the good story to apply or to see life through. The first bad story is superstition. And I'm going to define superstition in an unusual way tonight. I'm going to say that it's believing in the power of causes with no connection to a good personality and or to the good personality behind those causes. So let me say that again. It's believing in the power of causes with no connection to a good personality behind those causes. The reason that I want to define it this way is because it's easy to think of superstition as some sort of don't walk under a ladder and carry a rabbit's foot kind of a thing, you know. And that is superstition, to be true. And or, you know, if I eat two hot dogs while the kicker is lining up for his kick, then he'll make the field goal, you know. But those are fairly innocuous superstitions, and they don't necessarily affect your life greatly, except that if you go to a lot of games, maybe you'd get overweight from eating a lot of hot dogs in the latter example. But the real problem is, like a friend of mine, I'll give you an example of this, how I'm talking about superstition here. A friend of mine, she had come to Christ at the end of high school and had a really difficult family life, and some of us went away to college that she was kind of more closely affiliated with, and then she began to think that maybe she should, she started listening to Led Zeppelin, which is a great band, but she was really hooked on this song, Going to California. And she decided that she needed to go to California because God was talking to her through Led Zeppelin. And then furthermore, every time she passed a car, it seemed like these days, it had a California license plate. And so to me, that's the kind of thing that can happen when you essentially have a mode of superstition, because I believe what happened, she went off and ended up like following the Grateful Dead for a few years and got totally wasted on drugs and stuff like this. And I don't mean to make an easy moral lesson of this, but what I do mean to say is that it's not necessarily that passing a license plate from the state you're thinking about moving to is a bad thing. It's that if it's the only thing on which you're basing your decision and there's no real relationship to the personality who wants you to move to California, then it's essentially just hollow. It's superstition, and it's a flimsy story that's not really going to work. And ultimately, it leads to kind of this fearful thing where you're at the mercy of your circumstances all the time. You're always reading the omens, and you're stuck with the interpretation of your life based on your surroundings. And that fear and anxiety keeps wonder and innocence at bay, which are the things that we're trying to hold on to here, you know. Another story that's bad is the idea of being a victim or victimhood. And in this story, basically everything relates to you. Starbucks stopped serving your favorite drink because the universe is against you. And it's just more proof that your mother was right, that you're a miserable kid. That kind of a thing, you know. And it's, if you've been around people who are severely victim-minded, it's almost funny the way that everything can be twisted. And usually even the good times get spun in some way so that it's like, you know, yeah, it's great, but you know, I'm probably going to have a car accident next week and that'll be the end of that, you know. And it's like, excellent, dude. And so the effect of that is there's this consuming selfishness that ejects the same wonder and innocence that fear ejected in the story of superstition. So you see, you can see, I mean, I could go on with all these different stories, and there, a lot of them are tied to faith systems, and different religions have different sorts of stories which are common. But you can see how these stories, when you apply them, you begin then to symbolize the events of your life, and particularly the tragic events of your life, in a way that works, but isn't necessarily bearing good fruit. It's suppressing the best parts of yourselves. Even if it works for a while in a way that sort of alleviates pain. So the good story, you know, I've kind of given you a definition of each of these things and an example. And when I get to the definition of the good story, it's hard to give a good definition. And I think that's part of the mark of it being the good story. Because these other stories are easy to define and everything kind of fits in this awkward, terrible way, you know, that Starbucks is part of the great conspiracy. It's just a given, you know, and it's an easy fit. Whereas the good story or the gospel or the good news or the story of God and his people, however you want to articulate it, the good story doesn't fit easily. It's not obvious. And I think it's part of why wrestling is so important, because you have to look for it and you have to find it, and it takes your whole life. That's why Paul talks about, you know, the final day when we're saved, because this whole thing is this working out our salvation with fear and trembling. This kind of like consumed with finding the good story here. How do I find the good story? And particularly when you've been through really difficult things, it becomes all the more crucial to really find it. Do you know what I'm saying? The other thing about not having too solid a definition is that all of a sudden, it's like the psalmist says, you've set my feet on a broad place. If there's not a simple, quick definition of what the gospel is, oh, it's four spiritual laws. If there isn't that, then there's this breadth to it that you can encounter people from different cultures, people of different gender, background, experience, time periods, everything, and there can be place for them made in this large story. But if there isn't that understanding of the gospel as this incredibly broad thing that has room for all of the world in all of times, in all experiences, then you don't have the kind of story that can really be adaptable. Does that make sense? And I think the way that you can find examples of it, which is the other thing that I've talked about here on these other stories, is right here. You're in the midst of the example. You find the example, I would say, I don't know if it's primarily, but it's sure one of the top four or five in community. You see it in other people. You see somebody else have the grace to forgive a situation that's awfully similar to yours, and you think, well, maybe that's an option. Maybe I really could have the same grace for that. Or you see somebody else having a positive attitude in the face of, you know, some terrible physical injury, and you think, well, you know, maybe I can live that way too. My mother was always this incredible optimist, and it kind of irritated me, you know, especially when I got depressed in high school. And she had a car accident, nearly fatal one, in 92, and it was a head-on collision. And she was in a great deal of pain and suffering for upwards of a year and a half after that. Well, I mean, sort of for the rest of her life, but especially right after that, as she was trying to keep her leg, which they nearly had to amputate. And the doctors were uncertain that she would walk again, and even less certain that she would be able to ride her bike again, which was something that she really loved. And it was like 2 years later or something, and she biked across all of Kansas again, which is something she'd done several times. So 500 miles on this leg that had been pretty mangled. And I took my mother differently then, because in seeing her example, I saw, you know what, it's possible that this optimism is the real deal, and that it really generates real stuff in her life, really good fruit, and that this is really the Lord. And I can go ahead and admit that I should also be an optimist, and it's not just that I understand the world better than her. You know, if you're optimistic, you're not paying attention or whatever. That's not necessarily true. And so the community of believers gives you those visions of God in different places and those portals to grace. Also, the Bible and therefore the history of the church, it gives you this incredible sense. When we went through Ruth, it was like this whole new window to how God works and how God moves in our presence, you know. And all those things then become examples of the good story to you. I want to read just a couple quotes that I feel like have kind of hit this thing in a way that I can't articulate, and also do a good job of sort of jabbing at the thing without defining it. This is from Buechner again, same book. Maybe the most sacred function of memory is just that, to render the distinction between past, present, and future ultimately meaningless, to enable us at some level of our being to inhabit that same eternity which it's said that God himself inhabits. We believe in God, such as it is. We have faith because certain things happen to us once and go on happening. We work and goof off. We love and dream. We have wonderful times and awful times, are cruelly hurt and hurt others cruelly. We get mad and bored and scared stiff and ache with desire, do all such human things as these. And if our faith is not mainly just window dressing or a rabbit's foot or fire insurance, it is because it grows out of precisely this kind of rich human compost. The God of biblical faith is the God who meets us at those moments in which, for better or for worse, we are being most human, most ourselves. And if we lose touch with those moments, if we don't stop from time to time to notice what's happening to us and around us and inside us, we run the tragic risk of losing touch with God too. I think this idea that Buechner touches on there, that essentially this good story is a very human one. There's another quote that I'll share with you later about just the idea of Christ as being human and dignifying humanity through that. Another little passage I want you to read, this is from a book called Here and Now by Henry Nouwen, which I'm fascinated with from a verbal perspective because it's Henry Nouwen's Here and Now. Okay, anyway, so I'm always making that joke, much to my wife's chagrin. We call that uncle humor. You know, your uncle always makes the bad, obvious pun, and you just wish he wouldn't. So that's me. This is a little section he has called Embracing the Pain. In the world about us, a radical distinction is made between joy and sorrow. People tend to say, when you're glad, you cannot be sad, and when you're sad, you cannot be glad. In fact, our contemporary society does everything possible to keep sadness and gladness separated. Sorrow and pain must be kept away at all cost because they're the opposites of the gladness and happiness we desire. Death, illness, human brokenness all have to be hidden from our sight because they keep us from the happiness for which we strive. They're obstructions on our way to the goal of life. The vision offered by Jesus, however, stands in sharp contrast to this worldly vision. Jesus shows both in his teachings and in his life that true joy is often hidden in the midst of our sorrow, and that the dance of life finds its beginnings in grief. He says, unless the grain of wheat dies, it cannot bear fruit. Unless we lose our lives, we cannot find them. And unless the Son of Man dies, he cannot send the Spirit. To his two disciples who were dejected after his suffering and death, Jesus says, "You foolish people, so slow to believe all that the prophets have said, was it not necessary that the Christ should suffer and so enter into his glory?" Here a completely new way of living is revealed. It is the way in which pain can be embraced, not out of a desire to suffer, but in the knowledge that something new will be born in pain. Jesus calls our pains labor pains. He says, "A woman in childbirth suffers because her time has come, but when she has given birth to the child, she forgets the suffering in her joy that a human being has been born into the world." The cross has become the most powerful symbol of this new vision. The cross is a symbol of death and life, of suffering and of joy, of defeat and of victory. It's the cross that shows us the way. I mean, you know, there's a certain sense in with that last line, it's the cross that shows us the way, is something that we've heard all the time, but there's something else about that mood that he creates, that sense that, man, maybe it really does make sense. Maybe it's not just meaningless suffering. Maybe it's not like Naomi thought, don't even call me pleasant anymore. Call me bitter because the Lord has made me bitter. Maybe there's another way to understand it that's not just all suffering and all bitterness, you know? Maybe there really is a sort of a redemptive way. Buechner again says, "Consider Jesus of Nazareth, in whom God himself showed how crucial human life is by actually living one, and hallowed human death by actually dying one, and who lives and dies still with us and for us and in spite of us." And that's the story. That's the good story. And there's room in that story, and there's redemption in that story, and there's hope in that story, and there's faith and love, and all these things that we're afraid really ultimately to believe in because we're so cynical and so worn out and almost mentally twisted from our stories that we've been living in. And it's the kind of story that you discover once and make this glorious sort of entrance into it. And on the other hand, it's the story that's constantly unfolding before you, and you never really know what's around the next bend. I've come to the end here, and I just want to, as we close up here and we're going to go into communion, I asked Mike if we could do an instrumental song at the beginning of communion so that we could all just have time to sort of think about this thing. And I'm going to ask a few questions for you to consider and also ask that as we go through communion, if we could kind of keep talking to a minimum, not like it turns into a dull roar during communion normally, but just try to be especially thoughtful of giving one another the time to think about these things. So the first question is, what do you miss about yourself in your own life? What do you miss about yourself in your own life? Two, why do you think you've abandoned those parts of yourself? Is it what I've talked about, the busyness, the embarrassment, or the tragedy, or are there other things that have caused you to sort of send yourself away? And then thirdly, how do you think God might be directing you to find yourself again? Is it possibly through being still? Is it possibly through lightening up and having a sense of humor? Is it possibly through learning to reimagine your life in terms of God's true and good story rather than your own small and claustrophobic one? So these are the questions that I just want to encourage us to sort of wrestle with and think through as we go into communion, where we have this incredible opportunity to celebrate this very same thing that Nouwen's talking about, this death of Christ which makes way for life. So I'm going to have Tim up, and he's going to share about that. Off. There we go. Can I pray real fast? Lord, I just thank you for these people. A lot of them are really great friends of mine, and I love them more than I tell them, probably. And I'm a fairly expressive person, so they should all know right now that I really love them a whole lot. I'm really grateful for the fact that we have these incredible circles of friends, these incredible opportunities to gather together and celebrate this good story that we're a part of. And I pray that somehow you would convert us on a daily basis from believing one version of the story that's amiss, that's too small, that hurts us and that sends these good parts of ourselves away. Convert us to believing in the story as it really is, as you've really made it. Help us learn how to face reality and all the complex aspects of it and still believe in you, hope in you, trust in you, and be confident that you're with us and that you've got our best interests in mind and that you love us deeply. In Jesus' name, amen.
One of the things that Don said to me when we were talking about his message is he talked about just how amazed he is that Jesus pursues him, and he used that illustration from Luke 15 where he talked about how Jesus leaves the 99 to go find the one. And he said, you know what?